Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. These are the stories coming up on today's program. Papal audience. Pope Benedict looks at St. Paul's teaching on the Church's sacramental life during his catechesis. Human rights cornerstone. As we mark the 60th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, we look at its enduring relevance and find out how today's anniversary is being marked in the Vatican. And Holy Land portrait. We find out more about the hopes and fears of the dwindling Christian community in Jesus' birthplace. During his weekly general audience, Pope Benedict focused on St. Paul's teaching on the Church's sacramental life in his continuing catechesis on the Apostle. Lydia Kane reports.
The Christmas spirit was in the air in the Paul VI Hall for Pope Benedict's general audience on Wednesday as the sound of carols echoed around the auditorium in anticipation for the Pope's arrival. When the Holy Father did arrive, it was to the cheers of the waiting crowds who had gathered to see him. During his audience address, Pope Benedict focused his attention on the sacraments, saying that St. Paul contributed greatly to our understanding of the sacramental life.
Baptism, he explains, is a sharing in the death and resurrection of Christ. We die to sin and we rise with Christ to a new life of mystical union with him. Washed clean in the purifying waters, we emerge sanctified and justified, and we put on Christ. Through baptism, the believer becomes a new creature, renewed in the Holy Spirit, and incorporated through the same Spirit into the one body of Christ.
Speaking on the sacrament of the Eucharist, the Holy Father said it seals the union between Christ and the Church.
In the sacrament of the Eucharist, the life of the Church is nourished and built up. Following the teaching handed down by the apostles, the Christian community does what Jesus did at the Last Supper, when he took bread and wine, blessed them, and gave them to his disciples to eat and drink. In this way, the memory of the Passion is recalled, and a foretaste of the heavenly banquet is given to God's people as they await his coming again.
Finally, during his discourse on this theme of a mystical relationship, the Pope considered St. Paul's teaching on the sacrament of marriage.
By pondering the teaching of this great apostle, may we grow daily in our love for the Church and draw deeply from the wells of living water that she opens up for us.
The Pope, speaking in Italian, said the Church is not a corporation but a body. He then concluded his audience by saying that his thoughts were with the youth, those with illnesses, and newly married couples, and he prayed to Our Lady of Loreto and the Lord Jesus to help the young, comfort the sick, and encourage those who have entered into the sacrament of marriage. I'm Lydia O'Kane.
It was exactly 60 years ago that the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was adopted by the UN General Assembly. The groundbreaking document was the first universal statement on the basic principles of inalienable human rights. In particular, it affirmed the inherent human dignity and worth of every person in the world, without distinction of any kind. The 60th anniversary of the Declaration is being marked in hundreds of different ways throughout the world. Here in the Vatican, the Secretary of State, Cardinal Tarcisio Bertoni, was to address a commemorative meeting on the anniversary, and this was being followed later by a special concert attended by Pope Benedict. The commemorative meeting in the Paul VI Audience Hall was being attended by several senior Vatican officials and the heads of the UN International Labour Organization and of the UN Food and Agricultural Organization. At the end of this reflection, prizes were due to be awarded to several recipients by the St. Matthew Foundation in memory of the late Cardinal Van Thuan, who spent 13 years in prison in his native Vietnam and inspired all those around him with his love, compassion, and unshakable faith. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights was drawn up in 1948 in the aftermath of the Second World War and the Holocaust. 60 years on from then, it's a mixed picture. Human rights are still widely violated throughout the world in different ways and to differing degrees. But on the plus side, there is now far greater awareness on the part of individuals of what rights we should enjoy. In this respect, the Declaration has been and continues to be a source of inspiration for national and international efforts to promote and protect human rights. Cardinal Renato Raffaele Martino is the president of the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace and was the person due to introduce and conclude the commemorative meeting held in the Vatican to mark this anniversary. Earlier, he told my colleague Emma McCarthy that our world would indeed be a far better place if governments and nations had adopted and applied in full all the Declaration's resolutions.
If only was respected what is in the Declaration, the world would be much, much better. I'm sorry to say that when I go around the world and I can see, touch with my finger, that the Declaration is not, many times is one, two, three articles. I cannot say that all the articles are neglected in a country. No, perhaps only few. But again, it's important that the Declaration be known. And so that is necessary to teach.
And for governments to apply.
And for government to apply. And that would be a good encouragement if the governments ask the educational institutes to promote and to teach among the young generations. This is important. I remember when Pope John Paul II came to United Nations, I was there as representative of the Holy See, and in his address to the General Assembly on the 5th of October of 1995, he spoke about human rights and spoke about the human rights as a grammar, natural grammar, that everybody must be respectful of. And this grammar that is printed in our human being. And after, at the end, he said, for us, the Catholic, the moving force is Jesus Christ, because he has taught us the commandment of love, and so we have to apply this to every person, etc. But this is the Declaration is not only for Christian Catholics, it's for everybody, because these little things are present in our human being.
In our DNA.
Yeah, in our DNA. And so, but with the means that we have at our disposal, we must let those principles known by everybody. Because if you don't know, if you are not reminded, it's difficult to apply.
This, of course, initiative is happily married to another initiative that's very dear to the heart of the Vatican. It's very dear to the heart for the Council of Justice and Peace. This, of course, is the award, the Cardinal Antoine Award, which will be given this year to the former president of the International Confederation of the Red Cross. Can you tell us about this award, what it means, and, of course, the other projects? It's the practical application of human rights being respected.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. This is exactly. This is when I told Pope Benedict XVI that we wanted to promote, to open the process for beatification of Cardinal Antoine. He thanked me very, very much and said, oh, I was waiting for someone who would propose that, because I am convinced that he is a holy man, and so merits to be indicated as an example to the Church. And so, in order to promote the knowledge of this great man, we founded this foundation, St. Matthew, a name of an apostle, in memory of Cardinal Vantuan, in order to promote the knowledge and to also to promote the process of beatification, because I just received a consistent amount from the Vietnamese of United States, and they sent this amount to help in the process of beatification of Cardinal Van Tuan. And so this figure, we want also name after him those recognition that we give to Cornelio Sommaruga, the former president of the Confederation Red Cross, and also to the other projects that are very important. Many of these projects I have been visiting, and so I could see with my eyes how marvelous are they. But this is only a small example of the myriad of projects that are going on in all the world, especially in the developing world, that merit to be shown to everybody, in order to let know everyone that there are people who do beautiful things.
That was Cardinal Martino, head of the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace, talking to my colleague Emma McCarthy. The UN, for its part, acknowledges that over the past six decades, governments have failed to fully abide by the principles enshrined in the Declaration, but says its message has an enduring relevance and influence. Afsane Basinpour is the director of the UN Regional Information Centre for Europe. She says the document's message is something we should all aim for.
This is a constitution of the peoples. We're not there yet. It's aspirations. We have made big strides. It's basically normative. Everything that has been adopted for human rights was based on this document. So this is what we're aspiring towards. Of course, lots of things haven't been achieved. And the UN doesn't have any powers to oblige its member states to do or not to do. We set the norms, and then we hope and encourage that countries will follow them.
Sandro Covani is director of the UN Interregional Crime and Justice Institute, and he says the principles enshrined in the Declaration have had a very strong influence on individuals, governments and nations over the past decades.
In my personal opinion, we can now say that it's such an important document that it represents, in a way or another, a kind of constitution of the peoples of the world. The protagonist of the Charter of the United Nations says, "We the peoples." Does not mean only the government or only the parliament or only the civil society. All what represent the will of people who stay together, which is the best of humankind. There are lights and shadows. In many countries, the Human Rights Declaration has inspired the constitution of the country. In many other countries, has inspired revolutions, sometimes even violent revolution. In a few cases, also non-violent revolution, like we have seen in many Eastern Europe countries. So many concepts are now very well known all over the world. There is no longer a person who is responsible of a genocide who can say that he's doing it without knowing that he's doing it against the principles of human rights. So any wrongdoer now in the world knows that if he does something wrong, the world recognizes what he's doing as a wrong thing. And his spouse and his children will know that the father or the mother were a criminal against human principles because they were not respecting human rights. There are some areas which are very weak. First of all, for example, there is not one single country in the world who can say we are respecting all rights, all the 30 rights, including the social and economic rights.
That was Sandro Calvani, head of the UN Interregional Crime and Justice Institute. And earlier you heard the voice of Afsane Basinpour, director of the UN Regional Information Centre for Europe, speaking to Emma McCarthy. As Christmas draws nearer, our thoughts turn to the difficult situation facing the dwindling Christian community living in the place of Jesus' birth. Surveys show that more and more Christians are emigrating from the Holy Land each year, and some fear that the Christian population there could become extinct within a few generations. In 1950, Christians formed approximately 15% of the population in the Holy Land, but they now form less than 2%. And nowhere is this continuing exodus of Christians more pronounced than in the town of Bethlehem, the birthplace of Jesus. So what are the hopes and fears of Christians living in the Holy Land? Is there a future for the Christian community there? And are they optimistic that a new impetus can be given to the stalled Israeli-Palestinian peace process with the upcoming change of leadership in the US? Well, to find out more, I spoke to Father Peter Vlasto in Jerusalem, who is the director of the Franciscan Foundation for the Holy Land, that was formed to safeguard the basic human rights and continued presence of the Christian minority living there.
A lot of pilgrims have been coming from the Ukraine and Russia due to the fact that the Israeli government has lifted up their visas, so they are now coming in thousands and thousands of people coming to the Holy Land to visit the holy sites. There is obviously also a good number of other nationalities, Europeans and Americans, who have been coming also. But as we near Christmas, it is slowed down a bit. We do not know whether it is going to increase when Christmas does come. Obviously, there will always be pilgrims from around the world coming for the midnight mass in Bethlehem.
So presumably the economic situation must have improved for the inhabitants, as you say, with these high numbers of pilgrims coming after so many, should we say, lean years.
Yes, that's correct. Fortunately or unfortunately, how you look at it, it has brought a lot of revenue to the Israeli government, the Ministry of Tourism. And it's interesting that about 65% of the pilgrims who do come to the Holy Land on pilgrimage are Christians. So the Christians are actually aiding quite actively the increased growth of economics for the state of Israel.
What about Bethlehem in particular? Presumably most of the pilgrims are coming there, but how difficult is it, you know, with the security barrier nowadays?
Well, last Christmas, the Israeli military were really very, very good to the pilgrims. They opened up the separation barrier. Of course, they checked the bus and see who was in the bus or who was in the car. But the rules have somewhat even changed a bit. They were even saying, I was told, to some of the pilgrims, the Israeli soldiers, Merry Christmas. But there is always going to be a sense of security. But we've had no problems last Christmas, and we're not presuming any problems for this Christmas.
What about the emigration of Christians from the Holy Land? Is that still continuing at the same rate?
In regard to the emigration of Christians in the Holy Land, it has slowed down a bit. Last couple of years, about 3 years ago, there were about 500 Christian families leaving Bethlehem every year. That seems to have slowed down to about 300. I think the fact of the matter that, for example, one of the church entities, the Franciscan Foundation for the Holy Land, who took up this challenge of stemming the Christian exodus, have been providing many, many college scholarships for the Christians in the Holy Land, especially in Jerusalem and Bethlehem. And of the first four graduating classes, 65% of the graduates are now dentists, engineers, architects, educators, business people. And so these young people who have benefited from these scholarships given by the Franciscan Foundation have now decided not to leave, and now they are staying in their land and working as professional people while at the same time having a job. They now have a place to live and they're able to pay the rent. So it has slowed down a little bit than before, so it's doing much better now. But there is still that crisis. There are a lot of young people who need to be helped, who need to be assisted, especially through education. In fact, in Washington, when I had an opportunity of meeting the Holy Father privately at the Vatican Embassy in D.C., he mentioned about the foundation and had said to me, the Holy Father, that its education is the key to keeping our Christians there. So we have always felt that giving a Christian a college education whereby they can then secure a job and then have money to pay for an apartment is actually working out, and we're very pleased with that.
But how easy is it for people to find a job once they, as you say, they have got an education, they have graduated?
Well, in Bethlehem, people who go to Bethlehem University, job situations are a bit tight there. Obviously, they cannot cross over to Israel proper, and so there is a bit of a problem. But still, there are people who get jobs in Bethlehem. But those, for example, who go to universities in Jerusalem, like Hebrew University, our statistics show that they are getting jobs, and even the Israelis are hiring them. Remember, Hebrew University is the Yale of Israel. So anyone going there and graduating, they have great respect for the university standards. And when they come out as an engineer, as a dentist, or what have you, our people are getting jobs. We're getting employment. So yes, there is a bit of a problem with some of the students, but about 65%, as I said earlier, are now have gainful employment as professional people.
But coming back to the emigration question, are the people that are emigrating mostly coming from Bethlehem, and is it mostly young people that are leaving?
The majority of people who are leaving are usually in their 20s because they have families and friends in various countries such as South America, Canada, and even the United States. And so because of their perhaps their financial situation, they are leaving. But it's one of those things that we don't have stats of what age group are actually, you know, are departing. But the young people, obviously, if they see no hope, they're the ones who are departing. But many of them don't have family and friends in the United States, in Canada, in South America. So we're making sure we're focusing on these young people to give them a college education to become a professional person, and they are staying.
You talked there about hope. We've just, of course, seen the election of Barack Obama, who will take power, of course, in January. How is that seen in the Holy Land? Because the peace process has languished for a long time.
Well, I would say, from what I could gather and speaking to a good number of people, that about 50% of the Israelis are very pleased with that selection, and the other 50% are not. I think the Israelis fear that perhaps he may be more pro-Palestinian or pro-Muslim because of his background or previous background. But I would say every Palestinian I've spoken with, they seem to be very pleased with the fact that he was elected president of the United States. So you have two different views here for two different reasons and rationale.
But do Palestinians there believe that there will be some progress, though, on the peace process? Or do they think now it's just basically in this sort of deadlock with nothing really moving forward?
Well, they're putting a lot of hope in Barack Obama that he will be able to do something. As I said, they're very positive about his becoming president of the United States. So I would say on the Palestinian side, there is some hope. And the concern is of who he's going to pick for different cabinet people. Of course, he has picked Senator Hillary Clinton for Secretary of State. They know that her husband had tried to do something for the Palestinians, and he was elected president. And so they do have great hope, and they're looking forward that Barack Obama will be able to make a change. So there's a positive spin on this in regards to his election as president.
Israel is pressing ahead with the final construction of the separation barrier, which is mostly completed, I gather. How difficult has that made life in general in the Holy Land?
Well, obviously, the separation barrier has really caused a lot of anxiety for the people living in the West Bank, such as, for example, the town of Bethlehem and Jericho. Many of these people who had jobs in Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, and Haifa are now not permitted to cross over. It's affected even from time to time medical services where people had emergencies and they could not cross over to Jerusalem, 6 miles north of Bethlehem. It has caused disruption in the social fiber where families are separated, where even children, young people who have been in their teens, have never stepped foot into Jerusalem, 6 miles away. So it has caused a lot of anxiety and concerns, financial concerns, obviously, with those people who were working in Israel proper. And the church is attempting to try to assist them. I know the Franciscan Family Center is creating jobs, small jobs in Bethlehem for young married people. We're trying to keep them busy with work, but it's a very big problem, and we need lots of financial help, perhaps more industries being put into the West Bank to assist our people. It has caused some great anxiety among the people living in the West Bank.
So how do you and how do Christians you speak to and come into contact with feel about the future of the Christian community in the land of Christ's birth?
Well, I would say that people are generally very anxious about that problem, and they do worry about it. But the people who are being helped through the Latin Patriarchate, who are being helped through the Franciscan custody, and more specifically through the Franciscan Foundation, if you speak to those people, they're very hopeful. If you speak to that segment of people, which at this point is small compared to the majority of people, but, you know, we can only do one thing at a time, but, you know, suffering is part and parcel of what it means to be a Christian, and of course the Palestinian Christians have been through that whole area of suffering, and it's something that we are still hopeful in the fact that as we create more jobs, as we give more scholarships, as we build new housing, a lot of hope is being raised, but obviously there will always be that segment of people who are concerned about their future, their children's future, and it's something that is not going to be totally resolved.
I was speaking to Father Peter Vlasto in Jerusalem, director of the Franciscan Foundation for the Holy Land. That's all from the English program for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programs on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.